Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 23rd, 2021, and welcome to episode 235 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and dungeoning with multiple users, or something of that sort. I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hello, Paul. I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm apparently fairly loopy, but otherwise I'm doing fine. And also today we are joined by Carrington Manston in Toronto. How are you?
I am indeed, and I'm doing well.
Fantastic.
Seven thumbs up for me.
Excellent.
Oh no, the side effects.
Anyway, so our host's topic today that we wanted to talk about is basically stuff around MUDs, multi-user dungeons, or whatever you'd like to abbreviate them as, how they progressed to mushes and moos and that kind of thing. I suspect that at least, well, so I know that my own experience with this is light and tangential. You know, like I did some stuff with it, but it's kind of like talking about video game collecting or something. Like I fear that we are going to talk about a little corner of things that listeners have a huge knowledge of. But so, also known as a feedback generator. But hopefully 70% of what we will say is true.
Wow. So, That's like
70% of the time it's true.
Way better stats than normal.
Yeah. So let's see. I guess Carrington, you said that you had a little bit of experience with interacting with these. I don't know if you wanted to start. Or...
Sure. Yeah, I really just played a single MUD when I was younger on CompuServe, which was called British Legends. It is still available today. Play today. You can go to british-legends.com. We'll throw a link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. And you can get access to it. The source code is also available online as well, the PP10 version. The source code is essentially for MUD 1. I guess we should back up a bit and say, like, what is a MUD? Mm-hmm. And versus a mush versus a moo. MUDs are the thing itself, like the genre of game. It's a multi-user dungeon. Oh no, I feel like I'm getting one of those things. Oh, okay, to explain that, let me go back in time even farther. Right. I feel like we're doing a Tristram Shandy thing where every time I bring up something, I'll have to go back in time and describe that. And then we just end the show and we never get back to where we started. But so let's start earlier.
The year is 1800.
Let's start in the 1960s or whatever. So there's Dungeon, which was essentially a computer role-playing game, single player, completely ripping off Dungeons & Dragons, like early Dungeons & Dragons, thus the name Dungeon. And it was, as far as I know, it's like NetHack. It's like that kind of thing, except kind of graphical. And it was on Plato. I think it was on Plato. People are going to write, oh, we are generating some feedback now. But I'm going to say 70% chance it was on Plato, because my memory of having seen images of it later, they look like Plato images. So I'm going to say it was on Plato. Got that orange kind of lines. Mm-hmm. So it was basically a version of D&D. You'd play one character, randomly rolled up, and you would go through a crazy number of rooms in a dungeon. It was something like 900 rooms. And in those rooms would be randomly generated monsters stripped, like straight out of the Dungeons & Dragons monster manual, like just complete copyright. It's just like this, here are orcs, here are whatever. It's just, you're playing D&D. It was popular. It was cool. There was then a version, I think, called the Tolkien Tower one, Orthanic, whatever. But what we're talking about today is like Dungeon was supposed to always be a multiplayer game, like from the beginning. But the cool thing about Dungeon, it was kind of underground. Like a lot of people know Dungeon as EBIT 5 because that's how it got hidden. Mm-hmm. So people want to play Dungeon, but you're not supposed to have Dungeon on these Play-Doh terminals. So people would put it on a Play-Doh terminal, then it would get found and it would get deleted. So that was kind of the game you would play, like try to sneak Dungeon into a Play-Doh server and see how long it can stay up there, and people would play it. So it often would get hidden as, I think it was called EBIT 5, so that's the other name it gets known as. It was supposed to always be developed into a multiplayer game, but it couldn't stay up long enough because it kept getting taken down. So I think that's the reason why it never became a multi-user thing on its own. But then we get MUD, which is Multi-User Dungeon. There was the first MUD called MUD, or MUD 1 is known as now, which was really a multi-user version of Dungeon. But MUD now then... it spun off tons and tons and tons of games, so MUD became a genre of games. It's like playing a D&D game. So D&D is a game, but there's also a D&D type of game. You want to play something else and call it a D&D game, that kind of thing, which no doubt offends D&D people, but whatever. Feedback is welcome. So you got Multi-User Dungeon, which is the same sort of thing, like randomly generated, go play a role-playing game, just there's multiple people in there. And the interesting thing was it became super popular partly to play the games, but mostly just to hang out in there. So you would hang out in the game to chat, to exchange things. And yeah, you could go off as a group and hack and slash or whatever, but it was... maybe more popular, or at least just as popular, to just be in there. And there were chat parts of like any server that's hosting this. Everyone's logging in. You could chat elsewhere. You could leave messages elsewhere. It just became a neat place to, instead, you're going to hang out in this world. And if we leap to the future and you think of things like massively multiplayer online role-playing games, yeah. Then like World of Warcraft, a lot of people, I played WoW for a long time, and like most people, the first year or so I played WoW, I developed a bunch of characters and I made them super powerful. And then the second year, I did a lot of fishing. Like I would go in with my super powerful characters. I'm like, I'm tired of the dungeons. I'm going to see if I can catch every color of fish in everywhere. And you just do that. You just kind of hang out with people. It's just what you do. The same thing happened with MUDs and I don't know, there became first graphical one was, I think, Neverwinter Nights. But the one I played was in CompuServe, and CompuServe, I think, licensed it, and then they called it, which is what I knew it as at the time, was British Legends. Mm-hmm. I didn't know at the time that this was MUD, and that this, like, all I knew was I was CompuServe account, and I could hang out with other people, and we could attack orcs and stuff in something called British Legends. And so that's really my only experience of an actual MUD. And then later there's Mushes, which I always thought was multi-user shared hack, but I guess it's supposed to be multi-user shared hallucination. That's new to me. And I think that's actually what it's actually supposed to be, but we always called it a hack when I was a kid. And then a Moo, so a Mush and a Moo are kind of implementations, a code base, really, versus a MUD as a genre, and a Moo is a... Moo stands for MUD, comma, object-oriented. So it's like GNU, that kind of thing. So it's a backronym. I don't know much about history. I don't know much about like the 90s and Deku MUD and stuff, which became the real combat-focused ones. And everyone says that through those, through Neverwinter Nights and Deku MUD, we can draw a direct line to MMORPGs of today, like stat-based, combat-focused, that sort of stuff. But for me, it was late 1980s, CompuServe, playing, just hanging out, version of fishing, but mostly text. Mm-hmm. What about you guys? Did you ever play in any of these sandboxes?
I didn't. I didn't have the chance, and I feel like I really missed something. One of the things I'm curious about is, you mentioned Plato. And one of the mm-hmm. videos that we have linked to in the show notes indicates that that is where this concept got its start. Mm-hmm. And also, you mentioned doing this on CompuServe. And then, of course, naturally the internet. But and the video that we'll link to also mentions America Online, where they were thinking, you know, people would just log in, get their email, jump back out. And they're like, how can we keep people in here so we can get more of our hourly money. I guess that must have worked.
Well, yeah, because it used to charge by the, you'd get so many free hours or whatever, but it would charge like by the minute. Right. So if you get an email, you want to log in, grab all your mail, log off,
right,
read everything, create a bunch of replies, log back in and dump it on again. Mm-hmm. I did not do that when I first became a CompuServe user, and it was all long distance calls to the States from Canada. And boy, howdy, my parents got some of those.
That's right.
But I'm curious if they had these like on multi-line BBSs, if that was a thing, or if these have just always been either online services or the internet.
We can only get so multi-user. The whole point of a MUD is to be like massively multiplayer. It's not four people. It's supposed to be hundreds of people.
Okay. Yeah. Then, yeah, that wouldn't work.
It's kind of the difference between that and a standard door game. Like the very concept was thousands of people playing at once. Mm-hmm.
And the worlds were big. So you weren't always like, you know, in a room with 48 people, you know, but you could, I mean, like, so that's, I did a little bit of this in, I guess it was basically, you know, college. And at that point, everything was Telnet. I mean, like, I think it was probably largely always Telnet. You Telneted into the place. So that, you know, like, I would basically meet up with my friends from high school and we would go around and mostly talk, but occasionally, you know, beat up a monster and then talk some more. You know, it's kind of fun, you know, sort of a, it's kind of a social activity, probably more social than like going to a movie. And yeah, so that it was fairly addictive, actually, you know, for that reason, because you really, you know, you feel like you're doing something social, even though you're sitting in your room, you know, typing on your little Mac SE30 or whatever it is.
It's almost like people took a text adventure and then they took something like IRC and they mm-hmm. grafted them together somehow to make a world where you could hang out and.
Well, it is very much like that. If you think the original text adventures and you think of adventure and stuff and leading into Zork, that is, I mean, I love those games. And that's essentially you're typing and you're solving problems, solving puzzles and stuff. And the original MUD has those. Like you've got those solve a puzzle to get past this room or kill a certain monster or get a gem from another location and use it in a third location, like that kind of thing. So they're very much related. And they are, MUDs are, even at the time, were graphical, but only in the sense that you would see a little picture of your dude with the sword. So you think like early Ultima 1 kind of game. So it's kind of like playing Ultima 1, but which much more stripped down graphics, but more graphical than playing something like NetHack, which like when I played that as a kid, I'd look at it and go like, I can't understand this. It's like, am I the asterisk or am I the backslash? Like what is, oh, I'm dead. I don't understand what's going on. I found it very difficult to understand hack games.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So MUDs were easier.
The one I was on, it was, you know, just like an Infocom game. I mean, there was no graphical representation of anything. It was really just like you were in rooms and you went around.
Oh, that's interesting. Us on CompuServe, you had a little map on my. I played on a Coco, and there was a little square that showed like the room you're in and you're like, I wasn't moving or anything. It was just like kind of a picture. You're here and you could see the exits and it was a lot of typing. It was all, in fact, it was all typing. It wasn't like using a joystick or whatever. But there were some graphics.
Was there a purpose-built client for CompuServe for the Coco?
There was a cartridge.
Oh.
On the side, and I would use my 300 baud acoustic coupler modem.
Huh.
Fancy stuff.
Yeah. I discovered that just because I was, you know, we were thinking about this, I found that the MUD that I was on still has like a web presence. I was on StarMUD.
Cool. The web is a fad.
Yeah. And it still exists. And if you go to history and look at an incomplete and outdated list of wizards, you can find I'm here, you know, in amongst the wizards from whenever that was. So I think that's kind of cool. But so one of the things that I actually kind of wanted to bring up about this, that one of the things that kind of kept me on it, apart from just like the social stuff, was that if you were this wizard class, then you could actually like create rooms and objects and quests and things. So that was, you know, that was actually a pretty interesting thing. Like there were bits of, you know, like the little area that I was a part of that I would write code for. So I dug around and found, you know, the code for this church basically that, you know, I was responsible for writing for. And you can sort of see it, like I've put it on the YouTube stream, although it's probably not readable there, but it's essentially, it's like a version of C. I mean, like it's actually relatively sophisticated. You have, you know, you include things and you inherit, you know, like if this is an object type thing, and then you give it, you talk about its characteristics, like what it's going to happen if you look at it and if you pick it up, how big it is, if it's a container. So these things, I mean, part of what's cool about them is that you have all these many users. They are interacting and they're going through these adventures, but they're also making new adventures for all those other users. So the place builds up pretty quickly. This is the kind of thing that struck me as very interesting, you know, mm-hmm. and kept me going even beyond just like, you know, killing monsters with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's funny that you're all wizards. It reminds me of Deku Mud, which is like the 1990, like the big one, I said, mm-hmm. From which spawns so many things that we think of as a CRMPG. CRPG. There's no one in there. A CRMPG. I don't know. So many acronyms. It originally had the three classic character types. Like you mm-hmm. in WoW, in online things, it is still the case. You got the Holy Trinity. You have a tank, you have a healer, and normally you have DPS. Like those, you're going to be one of those things in any combat thing. But when it started, there was tank, healer, and stone skin caster. Uh-huh. And your whole job was to cast stone skin on the tank and just make a better tank. Like that's it. You stand back and go, have tougher skin, have tougher skin, have tougher skin. Like what? And then later became a more rounded thing. But it's so funny how the original trilogy was almost there from the beginning, mm-hmm. but just had this weird, weird single purpose character. So makes me laugh. I have a DM from my friend Roberta, who's watching us live on YouTube, and says, I am mixing up two of the CompuServe games.
Mm-hmm.
And British Legends didn't have the graphics. That was a different one they had. So I may not know anything I'm talking about. We already have feedback.
That's right.
We only promised 70% accurate, yeah. So I don't know what she wants. That there was another one at the time that had the little graphics I'm thinking of. It's a different game. Okay, well, whatever.
Yeah.
Close enough.
Yeah.
It's interesting you brought up those...
She also says close enough. So yeah, that's good.
Those concepts you brought up, the healer and the DPS character, those are still elements of modern, like, first-person shooters.
Oh, sure, yeah, when you play WoW, you pick a role.
Yeah, so I've heard my son, who's a avid gamer, talk about those kind of things. And so this morning I was telling him, hey, you know where some of those things came from? They came from MUDs. He's like, oh, that's great, Dad. Thanks.
Yeah, right. That's great, old man.
Yeah. But no, he actually was kind of interested. Like, you know, some of this stuff goes way back. And it's funny because I hear him talking about those concepts even fairly recently. I didn't realize that they had come from the world of MUDs.
It's iconic psychology. You play a tank if you have a big ego. You play a healer if you're a boring person. And DPS is for all of the best of us.
Perfect. Be stronger.
Now
be stronger.
You know my opinion.
Yeah.
And now you might be able to guess which role I prefer to play.
Yeah. I lost a lot of hours to these. I mean, like, because time just flies by. I mean, it really does. It has a lot of the same kind of function.
And yet it gets billed.
Well, yeah, if you're not doing Telnet on a university, you know, T1 or whatever, then...
Well, we didn't all have that, exactly. Paul.
Well, and of course, not everybody was a junior in college or whatever it was, you know, at that moment in life. But
nope.
there's a link that I think Blake found to an article that Benj Edwards wrote. Let's see, where is it? It's on How to Geek. It's interesting, and it actually talks a little bit more about the distinction between a mud and a mush and these kinds of things, which I didn't, I'm not sure I fully grasped. But I think if it is, it's something that I do feel kind of like came and went relatively quickly. So I think it may well have been something that a lot of people missed.
Yeah, the moo is, the idea of an object one is what you were talking about before, where you're going to contribute, right. You're going to create objects in the game and stuff. And that stuck around. There's a nice article in that 50 Years of Text Games we talked about last episode. Recently, it had Aaron Reed put a thing about Lambda Moo, which came out in like 1990 and is still going and still seems to be going strong. So I'll throw a link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, and the thing is, I'm sure that there are people who were on many MUDs and had many little parties of friends that they would go adventure with or whatever. I was pretty much with just one. And the part of the reason was that I was friends with somebody from high school who was like an even higher level admin on this place. And he said, you should come check this out. You know, you can program it. So I don't know. Anything else we should be saying about MUDs? Maybe not.
Just one distinction that they seem to make with in that one article with MUSH, mm-hmm. which was that in that environment, you could program in-game versus in a MUD, you could program outside, like on the server side. But right. in the MUSH, there was a language that you could actually use in the environment to create a room or create activities, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I seem to remember that I remember reading past that and seeing that you could, you know, like to start building, you type like @dig or something. And I thought, well, so mm-hmm. this is also an antecedent of Minecraft. But I mean, it sort of is, right? I mean, like it kind of very much is, actually.
Well, that's true. I think Minecraft kind of splits off into two real distinct genres. A lot of people like myself tend to play Minecraft independently, like the single user mode. But mm-hmm. Minecraft is also extremely big in the server-based, you know, multiple people in the world. The one that I used to play on that was a multi-user was run by the Living Computer Museum, actually. Huh, I don't get on there much, but it's actually still alive.
Yeah, that's one thing about, you know, earlier in life, one feels like one has more time. To do this, like mm-hmm. I do sort of feel like I can barely game at all now. I mean, I start playing.
I thought it was going to be the opposite. When I was young, I thought, boy, howdy, it's going to be amazing. When I'm going to be employed, I'll be older. I'll have so much control of my life. I will have lots of finances. I'll just be able to play things all the time. That's not how it worked out, man. When I was young, I had so much more time to play. It's weird.
Yeah, I don't know. It is odd. Maybe some of it is like, you know, time. Speed perception or whatever, but you know, that's
but I could easily dedicate, you know, hundreds of hours to playing a game back then and not even worry about it. Now I think, oh, can I really spare like 250 hours to play this game?
Okay, so I think I'll maybe move on to feedback unless anyone want to get any parting shots in.
Nope, do it.
Okay, I have a little bit of feedback. So last time we talked about the Osborns, there was an auction with Osborns in it, and there was an Osborn 1 and an Osborn Executive, and we decided there was an Osborn 2, and then we started wandering around wondering about whether the Vixen was the Osborn 4 and decided it actually was, and we weren't sure what happened with the Osborn 3. Santo on Facebook wrote in to say that there was an Osborn 3. This is what it looked like.
Oh, goodness.
And as, of course, it was the case, the Osborn 3 came out after the Osborn 4. So,
was it actually released? Did they sell these?
I think it, well, let's see. I mean, it has an available date. Announced October 1984, available spring 1985. So I think it was, but it was also MS-DOS. It was a PC compatible. It was not a CPM computer like the 1, 2, and 4. And I'm not sure that I've ever seen one of these. Apparently they existed also as, it's a rebranded Morrow Pivot. The Morrow Pivot looks the same. The Zenith also had one called the Zenith Z171. Anyway, interesting looking machine.
Fascinating.
I had not heard of the Osborn 3 before that.
Every picture for all those computers is showing the same thing on the screen. It's like a calendar with a graphic beside it of the world, essentially the continents of the world. And I wonder, that makes me think this isn't a high resolution graphics thing where that changed, that was I can display this screen.
Yeah. I wonder what it was that they were trying to do with the little image of the world there to the right either. I mean, like, you know, pick a time zone, maybe
make their calendar look fancy.
Yeah, because it's actually like a movie aspect kind of screen. I mean, like, it's very wide and not very tall. So
like the 2C portable Apple 2C has that little monitor, the kind of ones where you think you really could use some more height on this monitor.
Anyway, so that's
interesting.
I don't know, because honestly, I don't. It's irrational, but I mean, I guess a lot of this stuff is. But I'm much less interested in it because it's IBM compatible. Then it just seems like a compact, and like the fact
sounds too useful to you,
right? Exactly. But okay, let's see. So the another piece of feedback that we got, Shane wrote over email to say that Bob Spencer, who was one of the main engineers on the Altair, passed away last month, and it was somebody that Shane knew a bit, and so one of the things that we were sent was a link on 8bitboys.com, but basically just sort of talking about some of the stories that he had and about the Altair days, and also links to a couple of interviews that were done with Bob Spencer beforehand. And so apparently Bob Spencer was also he created the MITS Attaché, which was sold under ICOM, who bought out MITS, and I guess it was another computer platform, and it's sad news. This is not somebody whose name I knew prior to this, but we now have a way to learn more about this person if you did not know him mm-hmm. before. Is this somebody that either you were familiar with prior to this?
No, Altair, yes. And MITS, yes, but Bob Spencer, no. The site itself that we're linking to, 8-Bit Boys, is neat because it keeps changing the icon to the pointer is, I'm presuming, a MITS-related thing? I don't know what that is. Do you recognize what that arrow is from?
Yeah, it's using some sort of, whatever CSS magic to make the arrow be sort of northwest pointing orange big arrow.
But do you recognize that icon?
I do not.
I don't either. My Altair experience definitely had no pointer icons.
Yeah, although I think this may not be an Altair-based site.
Oh, I see. Right. Is it just a general 8-bit site? Okay. So it might be a Commodore thing, and that's why I don't know it. Because, Commodore.
Yeah, because here I see something about it.
Still hoping for feedback.
C128D, SX64 mentioned. So, yeah. Commodore seems likely. I don't know. Does it look familiar to you, Earl?
A little bit. I'm wondering if that's the one from GEOS, which I didn't use a lot.
I see.
But I didn't know the name, Bob Spencer. I thought the article was a good tribute and thankful for the feedback so that we could cover that here. Mm-hmm. The attaché is interesting on that article. Is this implying that Bob Spencer is the one who designed that computer?
I believe so. That was my reading of the email that we got, that was basically his project.
So that's really interesting. So that computer is one of the ones that I got in the Altair Hall that I talked about a few shows ago.
Interesting.
And cool. ICOM was one of the companies that Pertec bought. They bought MITS and they bought ICOM. Mm-hmm. And in one of the news stories, I'll actually talk a little bit about ICOM a little later in the show. So it's an interesting coincidence.
Together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bob was the engineer who developed quite a bit of the Altair 8088 and completely designed and built the prototype for the MITS attaché.
Wonderful. So, the attaché is really interesting because it's like an Altair 8800 with a keyboard, and there's actually a video card in there that serves as the terminal. So it's kind of like an Altair all-in-one sort of thing. And I'm not sure where it fits in the timeline, but I think it might have been among the last of the computers in, generally in the Altair lineup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. It looks, the way it's set up in this photograph we have of it, it looks like an Apple II. It's got this little mm-hmm. security monitor on it and a little stack mm-hmm. of disk drives, and it's kind of Apple II shaped. okay, let's see what else. I think there were three more feedback that I want to talk about. So David wrote from New Zealand. He said that he was working for government archives, and they were basically digitizing audiovisual materials. And so what David had come across was basically it's a music video by a New Zealand band, New Zealand new wave band called MySex. I don't know. Whatever. But apparently that's adapted from the name of an Ultravox track. Another thing that I don't know very well, but the The song is called Computer Games. It apparently made it to number one in Australia and number five in New Zealand. It was like very popular from 1979. And it has this video, which is essentially shows them breaking into the Sydney, what is it, Controlled Data Corporation center, and, you know, like goofing around with all the computers and things in there. And it features video game graphics in the background from various games. It's quite ridiculous, but very sort of period. So
what year was it from?
1979, and I'd never heard this song before. It's pretty strange, but apparently good enough to be popular.
And it's from 79, but it has that very early 80s mm-hmm. look to it. I haven't heard this yet, but I'm watching this video. I would have pegged these guys at 82, so they are forward future people.
Yeah.
Trendsetters.
No doubt. But it is actually also kind of cool that they're sitting there in you know, actual data centers with, you know, big machines mm-hmm. with disk packs and spinning tapes and stuff. So, Adam wrote over email. At some point, I had discussed the fact, you know, I had just moved to a different place, and in the old place, there was this rabbit that we would feed grapes out the window, right? And I think, in fact, maybe Carrington, you were the one who said, "Well, you know, I don't think there was ever a computer called the rabbit."
Sounds like something I would say.
Feedback generation time.
So, I dare you to send us feedback with rabbit computer. Why, does it turn out there was a rabbit computer?
Yeah, the rabbit RX-83.
Oh.
It was sold in Hong Kong as the rabbit RX-83. There's a.
Can't believe I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it, you know, so it looks like a little it's a little bit like a ZX80 or a,
which we now know is easily smuggleable
right.
into the USSR.
That's right.
In our last episode. That's the big advantage of this form factor.
So it was also sold in Belgium as the GEM 100. What we have here is a link to a flyer from the 1983 CES that just has the specifications and stuff on it. In the sort of metadata notes on the archive.org thing, there's a, you know, it's a little discussion of the of what was known about it. I had never heard about it before this moment, so I guess it must not have sold a lot. But it was also released as the CCE MC1000 in Brazil in 1985.
Cool.
Anyway, so there we have it. Now we need to get a rabbit.
Love learning new stuff.
Yeah.
I bet there was no computer called a aubergine. I'll throw out one every week. See if somebody can find that.
Start searching, everybody. yeah, let's see. Okay, and then the last thing. This I was very close, actually, to just making this an item of interest in news, but I will take the opportunity to get an extra one in, I guess. But Tony wrote over email talking about this thing, New Print 80, which is printing new things on old computers. And Earl, I think you actually replied to his email, right? You saw this in the feedback.
I did. I saw this was neat. I was a little bit sad that it looked like it was just TRS-80 specific. I wish there was a more generic kind of thing that would use the Centronics type connector. You'd just plug in any old computer and print to a virtual. But no, I thought this was great. This was, you know, because I think printing is one of the experiences that we often miss with retro computing. They're big, they're bulky, they break down, it's hard to find ribbons, you know, and they're noisy. And so just...
Well, you're really promoting the hobby there, Earl.
Like, well, we talked about this on RCR once, didn't we? That
I'm
printing,
sure,
it's one of those interesting niches of the retro computing hobby. So I thought this was a fun way to be able to kind of virtually print, but not have to deal with all that other stuff I just said.
Yeah. So what it is essentially, it's a little Wi-Fi enabled thing that you plug into your TRS-80 model 1, 3, 4 or 4P printer port. And then it basically presents a web page that you can then point your desktop computer at, and you can see it, you know, you can see what it's printing basically.
Such a fun idea.
Yeah.
Honestly, so cool.
That is amazing. That's a great idea. I even like the look of it with the stripes and the tractor feet and stuff on the side. That's delightful.
The old green bar paper simulated. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is really nice. Yeah. And so I too thought, you know, does such a thing exist for, because this is a fairly specialized interface. And I was wondering if such a thing would exist for a little more common interface. You're right. Like the Centronics ones, every printer, like half the printers in the world had that.
Mm-hmm.
Or half the, I guess we don't care about the printers, but half the computers in the world could connect to printers that way.
Right. They might not all spit out the same codes. Like the Commodore would spit out different things than, say, I don't know, an Atari or like an IBM compatible. But if you could get one that had the Epson control codes, that'd be more than half the battle, because most things...
That's what I was just thinking. Like, yeah, if you could just standardize on a control code thing.
Yeah. But I really like this project. So I'm kind of hoping that such things come to exist, at least if they don't already. This was a totally new idea to me, so I don't feel like I've come across this specific way of kind of like using Wi-Fi and connecting with modern computers before. I think this is really kind of cool. It's obvious in retrospect, but it had not occurred to me at all.
I think it's funny that they say a ribbon cable power adapter and printed user manual, not including the prices low. Why do you need a ribbon cable?
Yeah.
Print your website. That's funny.
Well, I think you may need to actually connect it to your old computer, though. Yeah.
No, I was joking because, you know, also that's a printhead case, so I'm making you funny.
I'm raising my thumb.
I'm making you not very funny.
Your thumb go to jail.
So, anyway, it's pretty cheap. If you have one of the relevant computers, it's $36, you know, plus $5 to ship it, but they don't ship internationally at the moment.
Boo, says the Canadian. Well, I don't have a terrace lady anyway.
Those grapes were probably sour anyway.
Those grapes were probably sour.
But actually, the other thing too, this is Plaid Vest software, and they actually have a couple of other kind of interesting things, which I just quickly also wanted to mention too. So,
how can something called Plaid Vest not ship to Canada? We're like all plaid all the time up here.
You guys invented that, right?
Yeah, totally. It's like issued to you when you're born. Here's your baby. Here's this plaid. Like,
So this is, you know, obviously this is a fairly TRS-80-centered website, but another product that it has is the new Key 80, which is a Atari joystick adapter and a keyboard adapter for PS2 keyboards and USB keyboards. So if you want to, either because you don't like your TRS-80 keyboard or because it's broken, you can use this to actually, sort of connect a modern one to it. And the site actually even identifies a particular keyboard that will fit into the frame of the actual like Model 3. So,
oh, goodness.
So if you wanted to.
Okay. Because I was going to say, like, why would you want to do that? Because it has an inbuilt keyboard. You're going to have to, but okay. Especially if you could do something like that, then why not?
Yeah. So there's a little 3D printing file for a post that will, you know, support the keyboard in the middle. So it doesn't just bend, but.
Very nice.
Yeah, it is pretty neat. And so let's see. Another thing that this is on the site is Vicious Vipers, a fast action arcade game. So a new game for the TRS-80. And then this was actually the thing that made me want to keep talking about it. Was the there's a macOS app called the TRS-80 Screen Designer, which is based on these. I think we've seen these before in auctions or whatever, but these sheets that you could get that had a grid pattern on them that you used to design graphics. You know, you would buy them from Radio Shack and you would draw on them like graph paper, but they're sort of specific to
TRS-80s. Oh my gosh, yeah. Wow, that's bringing back some memories.
Yeah.
What was the resolution? Like 160 by 50 of what, you know, what was essentially character graphics.
Right. Anyway, I think that's pretty cool. I might just get and install that, just even though I have no computer to use this on. I think it's kind of a neat idea.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And once you do the screen design, it will give you a code output, you know, that you can then copy in and, you know, make that screen on your actual TRS-80. Okay, and I think that's it for the feedback that I wanted to mention. So we can now move on to items of interest and news. Carrington, you have the first one. I have a thing to say about that too, though, actually.
A thing about the thing that I'm going to think about? Okay, cool. Well,
so it turns out, I'm not sure exactly how this came to my attention. I believe that it was just sort of like subliminally a subject line that went by. But if you go to worldturtleday.org, it turns out
as
that
one
May
does.
23rd, 2021, this particular date that we are recording on now, is World Turtle Day. So, happy World Turtle Day. Carrington, go ahead.
Happy World Turtle Day.
Did that really say thank you for helping us celebrate?
I hope so.
I hope it did.
It did, yeah.
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
Well, I'm going to talk about an episode or an article on Paleotronic, which was a magazine we've talked about before. This one caught my eye. It just came out, and it's the first of a couple. It's part one, and it's about the evolution of Logo, the programming language. We have some listeners who really like Logo. People have talked about Logo at Kansas Fest. I've experienced as a kid in programming and playing with Logo, and most people know Logo is the turtle language. You have that little turtle, usually a little triangle. Looks like you're playing asteroids, but the world's worst game asteroids. We're just going to like pen down, move 50, pen up, rotate, pen, all that kind of stuff. So this is a deep dive into the history of Logo, and included already a whole bunch of things I did not know. So if you're interested in this language at all or the development of language, I think this article is going to be of interest to you because there are a whole bunch of stuff I didn't know. Like, it's the turtle language, right? Well, the original Logo did not have a turtle. It was on teletypes, so there were no graphics at all. Of course, there was no turtle. It was mostly used to do math and manipulate strings. I'm like, oh, just sounds like a normal language. Totally did not understand that, or did not know that. And then after the initial playing around with Logo and finding out that like it's supposed to introduce kids to programming and make the world easier. But if it's all about math and kids aren't good at math, and then it's still going to be, I'm not good at math on this computer, doesn't show it in a different way. So trying to revamp it, make it more accessible. And at MIT, they developed actual wandering physical robots that would move around and draw things, dubbed tortoises, not turtles. And then Logo incorporated a virtual version of those and called them turtles. I thought Logo came like out of the gate as a turtle language. I think of it like, why else would you use it? And so I had to denigrate it. But this was all complete news to me. I had no idea the order of creation for Logo. So that was really fun. And Paleotronic is such a great magazine. It has such interesting things in it. That was worth a link anyway, to remind people that it is awesome and people should read and subscribe to Paleotronic. So if you want to learn about the Logo from the 1960s onward and that turtles didn't come first, although it is turtles all the way down, then you should read this article. It's a good one. Have either of you used Logo before in the pre-turtle days? Earl, how old are you? Were you there in the 1920s or whenever the heck this thing came out?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought so.
It was a spring chicken back then.
Who knew? Logo and teletypes.
Yeah.
I did not know that. That was completely reversed to what I thought the past was.
This will be a really interesting read.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah, it's really good. I recommend it. I'm only like moderately interested. Some great photos. I'll scroll down a bit, but there's some really terrific photos of people in cool 70s outfits doing Logo. I'm like, just, it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. I, when I was a kid, like there's a science museum basically in our city, and one of the exhibits was basically a big arena that had a turtle in it, and you could actually, you know, you essentially gave it, I mean, it wasn't probably actual Logo, it was but it was still sort of commanding it to like go forward and turn right and that kind of stuff. So I know I played around with a physical robot a little bit that way, and I've seen photos of the MIT one.
I played around with a physical Logo that would move and draw and stuff as well. Here in Toronto at the Science Center, we have a big science center here in Toronto. I just said the same sentence twice, basically, but in different order. Make sure everyone understands Science Center Toronto here in is where it is. And I have loved it since the 1970s. It's a cool building. It's all this like really iconic brutalist concrete building. Let's learn science among the concrete and anger. But it's just delightful giant staircases and stuff, and real, it's like hands-on science stuff. So it's kids just get, you know, run loose in multiple floors of hands-on science things. It's really, really fun. And one of the exhibits there from when I was a little kid was turtles that you could manipulate around and grab things and stack stuff and things. Very, very Logo, but hands-on. But who knew that Logo predated turtles?
Yeah.
And that the original hardware devices were tortoises, not turtles.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
You think turtle would be easier, but it said tortoise. I'm vague on the difference between a tortoise and a turtle. Tortoise is always going to be bigger, but I bet it's a live in the water, not live in the water thing or something. Or maybe they're totally different animals. I don't know. Feedback is welcome.
Right.
Google exists.
I think now on, we should just get on the podcast, say a bunch of words, and let people correct us.
Yeah.
And then every other episode can be an errata. I think that's how we should do it.
That's
that really
much
cut down on the editing for you too, Paul. I think.
Right.
Looks like turtle shells are streamlined for swimming, and tortoises have rounded and domed shells.
For riding.
For riding. Be more like a dinosaur or a helmet. I like it. Good choice, tortoise.
The people behind Paleotronic are also behind sort of a more modern thing called Turtle Spaces as well, which is... It's an advanced logo programming language interpreter that, you know, sort of works in a modern environment. So it's got like 3D capabilities and stuff. So.
Is there a version of logo to control modern Teslas in their auto driving format? That'd be pretty cool. Write code to get it to and from the store.
Right. Yeah. Just don't make a mistake.
It'll crash.
I think we, sometime, it might have actually been a host's gift idea at some point in the distant past.
A Tesla?
Not a Tesla, but it's like a Roomba, except without the vacuum part. You know, it's basically just like it's essentially like a little turtle. You can program it. It's sort of like the programmable guts of a Roomba. iRobot sold these things.
I remember that.
And so you could make your own little thing that would wander around the room and bump into stuff or whatever. But that, I think that would be, that would be sort of a fun thing to sort of connect up to logo. I mean, it's practically the same thing.
I can imagine cops catching bank robbers because the getaway car, they issue a pen down command. We'll be able to find them.
That's right. And Earl, back on Mitz and Altair and so forth.
Yeah. Some links to a series of YouTube videos that talk about giant floppy drive systems. So the company we talked about before, ICOM, existed prior to getting bought out by Pertec, the same company that bought out Mitz. And they made these dual 8-inch floppy drive systems, the first of which, when you watch the video series, you find out weren't necessarily for microcomputers. They were for bigger systems like a mini computer or something like that. But it turns out that, of course, intrepid microcomputer people want to connect them up to microcomputers. So, found a way. And the video series covers three in the ICOM series of devices. The first, I think, is the 3202, which was similar in concept to the Altair floppy drives. And then there's a 3712 dual unit, which were single-sided, single density. And then the 3812 unit, which was single-sided, double density. And one of the interesting things about these drive units, the 3712 and 3812 at least, is that they, and you see that giant, so right now what Paul is showing on the YouTube is a giant controller card full of TTL chips. It didn't have a CPU. It had what was essentially a really complicated state machine implemented in TTL logic. And the point being, that the interface in your computer could be very simple, just a easy parallel interface. And this board that was in the floppy unit did most of the processing. It did the heavy lifting, as it were. So think similar to something like a Commodore drive or an Atari drive that are intelligent devices and just connect with a simple interface to the computer. This was the same sort of thing, but, rocking it in the 70s. And they tended to go out of fashion when Western Digital started making these super integrated floppy controller chips that you could fit on a tiny little board instead of a ginormous TTL board. But very interesting devices. And Mike Douglas, the creator of these videos, and also, as I recall, the creator of the Altair clone, he restored these and then talks about what they can do in the process and how you hook them up. And shameless plug, when you look at the 3812 video, that's actually my unit that he's restoring.
Nice.
I shipped that off to him, and he did some great work diagnosing. One of the TTL chips had died. And the other thing that we wanted to do on that giant controller board were some ROMs. And so we had the schematic for the board, had other information about the board, but without the contents of the ROMs that worked together with the other chips to make the state machine, really, you'd never know how to diagnose one if it died. So he was able to get those ROMs out of there, and he even cooked up some custom circuitry to dump the contents of the ROMs. So now this whole thing is preserved for posterity.
That's super cool. And you're right about the size of the board. For people who are just, for those listening at home, the board is pretty.
It's ginormous.
Altair is a big box. Like, people forget, like, Altair is a sizable computer. The modern replicas, maybe little tiny things, but the actual Altair is a fairly hefty thing. And if you laid two of these boards, would cover the entire top of an Altair. So that's a giant thing. So that couldn't have gone in the Altair. You'd have to have a controller. You couldn't fit it in there.
I think it went on the drive.
It must have gone in the case for the drive.
No, that's right. The drive has its own case with two of the 8-inch floppies and that controller board and a big honking power supply and a very noisy fan that when I turn it on, I bother the whole house with it. And it is, it's just right behind me here. It's like roughly the size of the Altair, maybe even a little bit bigger, maybe a little taller than the Altair.
Oh, like the drive case?
Yeah,
wow.
The case Holy where cow. The drives and the controller board go in.
Well, two 8-inch drives.
It's pretty wide.
Yeah. But yeah, this is big.
So you can learn some things about the ICOM floppy drives and some of that. One of the other interesting things is with two of the double densities, I think they're a little over 400K a piece. So, you know, you'd be boasting like 800 and something K of storage, which was actually quite a bit when you compare it to the normal floppy drives that we saw in things like the Trinity of Computers in the 77, or a little bit later, we had like, what, 140K, 180K was pretty typical. So, you know, the storage came at the price of having these ginormously sized floppy disks. And of course, they went out of fashion. And
so you're about to say they're out of fashion. Big Altair muted you. Like,
exactly. You know, watch out for it. It was like, you're not talking smack about me.
Big Altair can't keep you down. Considering you now have more Altairs than like anybody. I don't know what a big Altair is going to be. You are Big Altair.
You know, actually, I kind of think they may be keeping him down, though. I mean, if there's anything that's going to weigh
in
you down.
In some ways. Well, didn't I joke about that Steve Wozniak had said he didn't trust any computer that he couldn't throw out the window. And as I get older, the percentage of computers that I can actually throw out the window is getting bigger and bigger. So
I only trust Sinclair.
Exactly. Radio Shack MC-10, that's it. Nothing bigger in the house.
So my thing is, it's just sort of like a small little article that came across my screen. Apparently, this is not from any time recently. Now that I look at it, it's from 2016. It's on a site called Alfer, it looks like. I don't know the site. But it's by James O'Malley, and it's called The Teletext Salvagers, How VHS is Bringing Teletext Back from the Dead. And I think already from the title, you can kind of see where this winds up going. But so teletext is basically this kind of like signal on a different channel that would accompany television. Like the BBC had CFAX that would go along, where essentially, you'd have the stuff you were watching, but then there's also this sort of like text channel that's not displayed on your screen, but you had a decoder that could decode it. And I think it was, it would just keep sending this data to you. And so if you wanted to, you could sort of browse around it, but you had to wait for the data to cycle to you, right? I mean, like, so you say, I want to see page 5, and then you have to wait for it to get to page 5, and then it'll capture and display it. But, so the stuff that they actually sent across the teletext is, it looked interesting, and it was sort of current scores of, games and things like that, and weather and whatever, theater, things like this. Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of stuff that the broadcasters, this is largely sort of BBC related, but so the broadcasters had to keep some of this stuff, keep some of their, programming content around, but they it didn't seem like they were actually as constrained with this teletext stuff. And so it basically just vanished. I mean, like, you know, that it was gone immediately. and so what this person discovered basically was just that, you know, at some point was looking at a VHS tape from the attic or whatever. And there's a little, like, you know, noise line on it, which turned out to have actually captured the teletext data. So the article is kind of about going, you know, going through and kind of like doing whatever kind of noise reduction stuff you have to do in order to an error correction and stuff to try to get the teletext back out of this. But the point was that, you know, if you just taped some ads or taped an episode of, you know, whatever, Dallas or something, then it will have this little info line on it. And so it's sort of talking about how that has been done. There's a Twitter account I think you can follow. Of course, this was 2016, so I don't know if it's still around. But I think it's using a Raspberry Pi to help with this.
That is super fascinating, because you forget that this wasn't just another broadcast channel, that it's instead interpolated data. And I guess it could have been captured by a VHS. That's amazing.
Yeah. So I mean, in the show notes, I had labeled this teletext preservation by accident, which I think is actually pretty accurate about like how, what happened here. I mean, like, you know, you were trying to save something else, or maybe, you know, you just accidentally left your VCR running or whatever. And you wound up with a preserved bit of teletext. So that's pretty excellent. Yeah. Right. Mm. So Brandon says, now we'll know what the West End Cinema times were in 1992. Thank goodness. but it's cool. I mean, you know, it's probably much of what has been saved is not going to be of interest to anybody, but it's still very cool that it exists. It'll be nostalgic for many people, I'm sure, regardless. So anyway, yeah, the teletext archaeologist at @grim_fandango still exists and still tweets. Still, I mean, you know, and is retweeting things as recently as like 9 hours ago. So, yeah.
That's awesome. The service kind of lives on in the Red Button stuff from the BBC.
Yeah, I wondered if that was the same.
I think of that as its own thing. They were going to cancel that, I think, last year, but then decided not to. So that still exists. You can still kind of get this kind of thing through Red Button.
Yeah. Cool.
Did Canada do teletext?
No, we can't do.
I think Michael said that like Australia had it, and I think France had it.
We write our news in the snow, and you don't want to know how right. We do it.
Yeah.
And you don't want to archive that. That is for sure.
You can't archive it. Very ephemeral here in Canada.
All right. I think that's all the items of interest and news that have been put in our show notes. So now I guess we can go to a word from our sponsor.
Austext is Australia's only national teletext service. With a teletext-equipped TV set, you can access information on news, weather, finance and sport, all at no cost. There are half-hourly share price updates and extensive TAB pre- and post-race information, a must for phone account punters. Austext has lotto results, star signs, pages especially for kids, and much, much more. If you can't get Austext on your TV set, ask your TV retailer to demonstrate Austext and see what you're really missing.
And I want to demonstrate one of the latest developments, which is the BBC information service CFAX, which I know a lot of people have already seen, but it comes on the market. It's been sold at Harrods this week for £395, and it's an information service. For that money, you get an adapter, which can be plugged into any television set, and at the press of a switch, there we are, this is the CFAX information page. In fact, this is just the index. I have here a little push-button device, which is a little bit like a pocket calculator. And by looking down the index, here we are, news headlines, page 101, news in detail, sport headlines, travel, today's recipe, and so on, we can play into our own television set, if you've got the adapter, any of the information. I'll try news headlines, Bob. For that, press the page number 101, and we can see the page numbers turning up there. And when it comes to page 101, then we'll get some of the news headlines. As you can see, it also includes the date and the time. There's even a bigger index, actually, at page 198.
It's rather like having a kind of second-by-second encyclopedia right at your fingertips. There are the headlines.
Here's the headlines on page 101. Miners' leader, Mr. Gormley, approaches the government on further talks. If you want more information on that, you can turn to page 103. But I'll just take it back to the index, Bob.
Let's try something else. Pick the his index.
Would
shall we try...
Shopper's
what about
guide?
The shop? Yes, the shopping guide.
Well, just try one more. Shopper's guide, which is page 142. And here we go. The pages are going round again. While we're waiting, I must tell you that in a couple of years, this should be much cheaper. And also, price guide, this page is being changed.
Ah,
it's my luck, isn't it?
How unfortunate.
Well, I was about to tell you, Bob, that back to the headline. Let's try the sports headlines.
Okay.
And while we're waiting for it to come up, let me say that in a couple of years' time, there'll be a newer device on the market, which will enable people sitting at home at the touch of a switch to get 300 million pages. Which means, of course, that in the central computer you could put in, well, you could put in the Holy Bible, War and Peace, encyclopedias and so on, and at the touch of a switch get all the information there
that
in your
is,
own living room.
That is mind-boggling, David. Mind you, if you find all this a little too intellectual, and if you regard the television set as being primarily for entertainment, even if you don't like the programmes, you can always buy, for much less money, this is only £20, the VideoMaster Home TV game set. Here it is. It's so simple, you just simply plug it into the aerial at the back of your set, and you can immediately play the kind of game that you normally only find in slot machines and fairgrounds and clubs. Now, this one is called squash, and by twiddling the knobs here, providing the ball comes out, of course, by twiddling the knobs, I can try and get that, whoops, that ball into that little hole. Now, there we go. Now, they reckon, you can actually adjust the speed of the ball, and they say if you have it at full speed, no one can last longer than 10 minutes because the concentration is so intense.
Armchair Jonah Bennett, Barrington.
Exactly. Now let that one go, because if you don't particularly care to play solo, if you prefer a game that you play with a friend, and I'm using that word friend loosely since I'm playing today with David Seymour.
Thank you very much.
You can switch to tennis. Here we go. Come on.
Wait a minute. I'm
not lost that one. There we go.
Feed the ball in again. Just here we go. Nastasi on the right.
Now,
that's me.
Now, this is me. I'll get your
I've got to play it back to you.
Again, here we go.
And how much did this cost, Bob, did you say?
It's £20. So for £20, David, you can have hours and hours of endless entertainment.
And we're back. So this time, in honor of the last news story, the host's retro computing gift idea was found by Carrington. So maybe Carrington can talk about it.
In the last 15 seconds.
Yeah, I was going to say way in advance.
So if you miss CFAX things, you can order a customized BBC football CFAX results mug. So you get to say what was the match, what were the scores, who scored it. So you can use an actual one, or you could make up your own and just have, you know, Team Canada beat everybody, as one should. But it's fun. So it's you get your little, so to commemorate a particular match or your home team or whatever, but it's a mug in the CFAX style. I'll try to share the link so people at home can see what we're talking about here. And it's delightful.
That's cool. Yeah. So you can say match, result, home scorers, away scorers, date. Did the match go to penalties? What was the outcome? And as when I read what was the outcome, immediately my mind went to like a D&D critical fail. You know, where, you know, like something just dramatically ridiculous happened. But
I can see if somebody was a super big football fan or just really enjoying Ted Lasso, then this would be a fun mug for somebody who's like old school and remembers turning into CFAX to see the results of the match. So I dig it. So you can get a retro BBC football CFAX mug.
And this is that otherworldly kind of football, right?
Right. The kind that's
the rest of the world need football. You American, it's the everywhere in the world except your tiny local space football. Yes, that one. Yes.
One other thing that I kind of like about this is the color scheme is very, it's very acorn. So, which perhaps, you know, there's a reason for that.
It's dishwasher and microwave safe. You can't lose.
Okay. So once you're done designing dream matches of various sorts, then you can turn your attention to eBay, and Carrington has the first things to show you.
Ooh, yes. I do. Goodness. Okay, let's go. What did I pick? Oh, this is interesting. So what's neat about this, I have picked an item that isn't a computer thing, is computer related. I want to know, do you guys know? It is a universal remote for your TV, the Core 9. And it turns out that this was developed, in a sense, by Woz. Woz and some others co-developed this thing, started a company, and put out the CL9 Core controller. I do not know this thing. It caught my eye because it's like, you know, Woz, rare, number one, exclamation point on eBay. But it is a sort of T-shaped, handheld, universal remote control by Steve Wozniak and a company I've never heard of before. So do you guys know that?
That's interesting.
I knew he did Apple stuff, and I knew he then got into music and did those big shows.
Right, the US Festival.
Did not know, did a core company and did universal remote controls.
Kind of an IR-based universal remote, like you might find today, but like an
presumably,
early
I know nothing about this. I found a site, K-tronics, that talks about it. That CL9 was the company, it was a Steve Wozniak company, and that they just made this thing, and then the company got eventually bought by Siemens, so there's later versions of this that are Siemens branded, but if you get the core brand one, then that's the one from Steve Wozniak's other company that I've never heard of before.
That's very interesting. You very often hear Steve Wozniak talking about television remotes in the context of, like, you know, pranks he used to play, but not an actual functional one that it does something positive.
Right. Now this is on eBay for $900, so it ain't cheap. So it's only for the Steve Wozniak completionists. Looks complete in box, not yellowed.
Yeah. No, it does look nice. This seller has a lot of very interesting listings, but they are always, you know, like a digit longer in their prices than you think they ought to be.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, no, this is that's amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I know something new.
So, Steve Wozniak, I mean, it's not really a computer thing, but it is a retro technology thing. And it's got Woz's name. Yeah. So that was my choice. Caught my eye.
Is it actually on the box anywhere?
No, it's in our hearts.
Oh, conceived, designed, and built by Steve Wozniak, the inventor of the Apple computer. It says in...
Our hearts are also on that box.
Yes. Wonderful. The only remote you'll ever need.
Is that true? Could we sue him now?
I don't know. Worth a try. All right. Let's see. Earl, we're being very themed today.
Did you pick a turtle?
No, but I did pick something that is in a hard shell that... moves around slowly. It's an Osborne 1. And the reason that I like this auction was that the computer looks like it's in really good shape. Now, the seller says that it appears to be working because it does come up to the boot screen. But the thing I would caution on that is that doesn't mean that the floppy drives are actually going to boot. But the good sign on this is that it did come up to the boot screen on the monitor, which at least shows that the computer processor and video display and that sort of thing appear to be working. So then if you got it and had to fix something up, that something might just be limited to the floppy drives. And it seemed like the price was pretty reasonable, too. Yeah. For a system in this condition and with some of the things that came with it. Like, I think there were a couple books, weren't there? If you scroll through the pictures. I should say what the price is. The price is $150 starting bid with a buy it now for $250, which isn't horrible for one of these in decent shape.
Yeah, I mean, because it looks nice, because it does seem to come up, because it has all the keys. I mean... Mm-hmm. That is pretty rare by itself.
And the keys don't look horrible or all banged up either.
I have an Osborne 1, and it's missing the space bar, and I'm not sure that I will ever be able to find a space bar for it. You know,
I have seen some Osborne 1s that are pretty dinged up, looking pretty janky, and this is not one of those.
I still don't understand the appeal of these computers at all.
Yeah. I was wondering when you were going to come in with that.
I know I'm the outsider here, but I just don't get it. I don't understand why anybody would want one of these things.
You mean as a retro collector?
Then or now.
Or do you mean back in the day or both?
In all contexts, from the beginning until now.
Well, this was kind
I
of a
didn't
first,
understand
right?
At the time,
that you could take all of your computer and theoretically lug it around with you. And I think the other thing that the Osborne one had going for it was the collection of software licenses that they negotiated and then could sell it all at one price, which sounds like a lot of money today. I think it was $17.95. But if you look at the software that you got with it and then the fact that you could pick it up and take it with you, that seemed like a fairly compelling deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's definitely not something that you would have bought for fun. It's not something that you would have bought to game on.
I guess maybe that's why I don't understand it. Even from the beginning, I'm like, well, if you can't game, why does one bother?
Well, I guess you could have run Zork on it.
Right.
But who likes text adventures, right, Carrington?
Oh, I'm just fighting words. I'll meet you in the mush.
I know this has probably come up a couple of times before, but you could at a certain point get for the Osborne a little Fresnel lens that you put in front of the screen, you know, so it's like it's Brazil style, you know, like, so it makes it.
I could say it's Brazil, totally Brazil. Yeah.
Somewhere there's an ad, and like we talked about this
really like a
three
giant
years ago
magnifying
or something.
Glass.
Yeah, something like that.
Osborne it's one like, with a 19-inch screen.
Yeah. It's but I can see that being useful because these are really small. In fact, I haven't really used them very much, but I thought that actually the screens were really windows on a bigger field, right?
Like, it is. Yeah, it was a 50-some character display, and I think scrolled back and forth for a virtualized 80-column display. So, you know, so take Carrington's antipathy and then double it because nobody loved that aspect of this computer.
I think that's a neat thing. Like, at least you can see something. But I guess, yes, it's like, here's your screen. We're going to show you this much of it. Like, you kill me.
Yeah. I mean, it's already small.
It weighs 3,000 pounds.
Anyway. Okay, so here's another computer that unlikely people would actually want. But, well, actually, this wasn't the one I meant. But this is that characterizes many of the auctions that I have located. I thought this was interesting.
What is this thing?
We've surely talked about these before. The Microprofessor 1, I guess you can sort of see it on the cover of this thing. But it's basically a little single board Z80 based computer that it has a, kind of like a chiclet type keyboard and a very little amount of memory. And it's basically just like teaching yourself. Like it's a educational machine sort of. It's you're learning assembly language on it. It's got a little display and stuff. What's interesting about this is that this is basically two of them, new, like in unopened boxes, and
with carrying
cases. And actually also with these sort of promotional bags as well that say MPF1 computer.
And what circa was this? What year were these guys?
That I am not sure about. I think I would have to look
Sorry,
that up.
Didn't mean to derail you. Just curious.
Let's see.
1981.
Was it? Okay.
That's what Google tells me.
What happened was, I guess, this was like old stock that some company, you know, like basically somebody bought out their old stock when the company went bankrupt. This, and they're all in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. So let's see. We bought an entire stock of hundreds of these. So.
Well, I was going to say, because at first I thought you get two of them still in box with these still shrink-wrapped carrying cases for $75 buy it now. I'm like, that doesn't seem like a bad price. I'm like, wait, there's five of these available. They got five pairs available. And then I start reading something, they actually have hundreds of them. I'm like, oh, the market for these is about to crash hard.
Yeah, although, I mean, the thing is that, so they're asking $75 for it for these two, but at least to me it's going to cost $130 to ship, so it starts, you know, like I can kind of see why they want to sell two at once, you know. But
these are actually shipping from Riyadh?
Looks like it, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, only ships to the U.S., though, not even local to Saudi Arabia. They want them out of the country. Get rid of these things. They are a blight upon us.
One thing that's kind of cool about them is that the case that they're in is, when you close it up, it looks like a book. Like you put it on your shelf and it looks like a book. You can sort of, you can kind of see it in the auction photos. It's there in amongst a bunch of books. It's, you know, the thing, it's a slightly fat looking book. And like, so the manuals go on the left side and the circuit board basically just sits inside the right half of this shell. And it's made, it's actually made by, what is the name of that company? They made modems later. Well, actually, Carrington, you're probably still looking at the Wikipedia page for it.
Multitech.
Multitech, yes.
Oh.
Multitech.
Which is now Acer.
Yeah, so it has a nice history. Okay, so let's see. What was the thing I was aiming for, the other computer that you probably don't want, is Jupiter Ace 4000. So the Jupiter Ace, you know, 4000. Well, first of all, I think that I'm not sure if there are many Jupiter's Ace. You know, like 4000. I'm not sure if that was the only one or if that's like a later model. But it's the same sort of form factor as the ZX81 and the, you know, like Timex Sinclair. It's and the whatever that other one we're just talking about.
A keyboard that is angry at its user.
They're a little light, cheap. You know, they were originally cheap. They are now highly sought after. Most of what I know about these, I know from Earl's podcast.
Talked about that a long time ago. They were fourth based.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's probably not fun to use, but it's an interesting object. And this has got to be one of the best looking ones I've seen.
So there was a Jupiter Ace, and this is the Jupiter Ace 4000. Are they different things?
I do not know. Somebody bought actually the IP from the, you know, Jupiter or Jupiter Ace or whatever is the containing old company. And so there were some auctions a few years ago, I think, of some of this stuff, like, you know, original prototypes and stuff like that. This one doesn't look like a prototype. It's just an instance of one, but we can see they're desirable because so this one is in, it's in Saint-Thérèse, Quebec, but it's already been bid up to $551 Canadian. So it's.
Well, that's like positive.
That's like $20.
Yeah. It is in reality almost $500. But,
Well, the good thing about a Quebec auction is Canadian dollars only go up to $999. We can't do four-digit numbers in Canada. So a good tip if you're looking for cheap things on eBay. Look for Canadian sellers. Cause
cars must be great there.
Okay, let's see. I had what's another interesting one? I don't know if we talked about this before, Earl, when you were on, somebody has an auction for a Max machine, a Commodore Max machine. This came up, I know, because I think at one point we had as a gift idea, patent drawings, and this was supposed to be there was a patent drawing that was supposed to be of a Commodore 64, and we could not make the patent drawing look anything like a Commodore 64 in our heads, but that's because it was this.
Right.
I'm a bad Commodore guy. I know almost nothing about this guy.
Yeah.
About the Max machine. I know that it is a collectible, desirable unit to have, has that really interesting spongy press keyboard. Don't know much more than that.
I think it's Japan only.
But it's silver and black look. Imagine if a Commodore and a Coco had a baby.
That is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Sometimes when a Commodore loves a Coco very much.
I think it does look kind of nice, although it also does kind of look like a cash register. But it's interesting. Yeah.
Some of my favorite computers look like cash registers, so I'm okay with this.
And it's a very nice set.
The bubble keyboards and stuff, I'm not okay with. They are terrible. They are inherently terrible.
So this actually has a nice condition box. It has the manuals and Omega Race and something else too. So, So, I mean, if you were looking for one and you had $2,000 Australian, then this is the auction for you.
So I just went to Wikipedia to confirm what I thought I knew, which was that this guy was a predecessor to the 64 and may not have been sold outside of Japan, actually. And That looked like Japanese writing on the box.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, actually, it says Max Machine, basically. But I think when we talked about it before, I think I inserted an ad for it, and you know, you can hear that, like, you can't hear much else coming out of the Japanese unless you speak Japanese, but you can hear Max Machine. So
it does look like it was sold in the U.S. though as the Ultimax.
Ah, interesting.
And the Vic 10 in Germany.
VC-10?
VC-10. Yeah, they wouldn't have called it a Vic.
Oh, VC-10. Yes, it would have been a Vic. Of course it would have been a Vic.
Yeah, another interesting fact about the Commodore.
yes. Let's see. Little known fact.
Okay, let's see. I think what else is interesting? This chatbot, I think, is kind of intriguing.
What?
So, I'm not sure actually how this came up, but it's
how do you find this stuff?
I don't remember, actually. But anyway, it's a toy. It's a Tomy toy. And it's a little robot that you can tell it, you know, go forward, turn right, you know, whatever. I guess it's also sort of logo related, right? Has a little wireless remote. But it has the ability to deliver messages. And so it's got a little micro cassette in basically its face position. So it's using the little holes for eyes, right? Which is really hilarious looking.
Adorable. Yeah. And it's the Canadian variant, so you must have to give it, like, instructions in Canadian. Go forth, eh? Go give that hoser a message.
on one side there's English, and on the other side there's French. It has a little tray that you can carry things with, and it has a little clampable hands that you can grab papers with. That's called the chatbot.
So what do you do with the little micro cassette?
You deliver messages. It's I think the thing about this is that basically, you know, you can record a message on the little micro cassette that's serving as its eyes, and then it will go drive around and then play it back to somebody. Surely this is much easier than walking to the other room and just telling them the thing.
For an introvert, this is easier.
Anyway, weird and funny thing. It is, buy it now for $237 Canadian dollars. So not cheap, but, you know, this one is in, everything's in Quebec today. Mont-Saint-Hilaire, which I always read that as, you know, something hilarious, but... okay, last one I will mention, which is a Synapse Relax Stress Reduction System, which I think that's kind of neat. So this is it's multi-platform. There's a patented control unit of some kind. I don't actually know. I'm not exactly sure what it's controlling. It's got some hardware, basically, and.
It delivers a mild electronic shock if you don't relax.
Yeah. I'm
relax
that is exactly
or
what it does.
Pay the consequences.
Yeah. I don't know. It's something that you interface with your computer. One other thing that's kind of neat about this is that it comes with software for many different platforms. So it's listed as being, I guess it does say Commodore 64 and Atari both, but it's also got Apple II and IBM. So IBM PC, PC Junior, Apple II. Atari 400, 800, Commodore 64. Some of these are on discs. Some of these are on cassettes. It looks like they're all included. This looks like it's pretty full, like a full set. I'm not sure I see the manual, but I'm sure it's figure outable. Anyway, so I thought it was sort of interesting. Interesting to see such a massively cross-platform thing. And it's not currently very expensive. Mm-hmm. It's $31, 4 days left, 5 bids already.
Since the software is essentially doing nothing, I think it's easy to make it cross-platform. it's like with holistic medicine. It's very easy to make multiple versions of it because, you know, right. Why not? The efficacy remains the same.
I think – so I guess there must be a sensor. Yeah, okay. I see one of the pieces here is a triple sensor.
Like a biofeedback thing?
Oh, just in your hand? You like strap it to your head or something, which would be much cooler.
No, I think it connects right up to your cerebral cortex. With that little plug there.
Jam it in your ear.
Oh, it says headband. I can kind of make that out here.
Tolic relaxation tape. Chat's hilarious.
Have you heard that? There was, I think it was probably Peter Serafinowicz who made this. the Dalek relaxation tape. It's really hilarious. But yeah, hopefully I'll remember to put a link to that in the show notes. But yeah, it looks like this has a headband. There's another one that I remember that had a kind of like something like a mouse that you held onto that would measure the like resistance in your fingers or something like that.
Yeah. Zap you. Headbands were big in the 80s. So yeah. I can see. Get your leg warmers and your headband.
I'm not sure that you want to find a used one.
Well, and so was stuff with skin conductivity.
Yeah.
Was a big thing back then in the 80s. Remember all the, like, the touch lamps you walk up right. and
get a shock?
I almost always did get a static shock from those things. You didn't want to ever turn on the light.
And I suppose it's the same kind of technology as a lie detector test, right? So it can say, like, you know, are you relaxed? And you can say yes, and it can say you are lying.
And then the chatbot comes in and says, no, you are not.
Yeah.
Shouts the pre-recorded message at you.
Anyway. All right. I think I will leave it at that. I found some other ones that I will save for some other day. But
awesome.
Very cool. So once you're done buying all those things, we can turn to closing discussions, I guess. We're already there. Amazing. Earl, do you have any closing thoughts? You've written something.
Just a quick thing. I've been having fun playing with this little Z80-based single-board computer. And for those watching on the YouTube, I'm holding it up. Mm-hmm. It was made by a gentleman in the UK who just decided he wanted to make a Z80 computer and open it up so that other people could buy it, which was cool. And it boots CPM off of a thumb drive, and the drive letters for CPM, you've got these folders, A through P. So if you just throw files in there, then when you boot up CPM, you see those files on those drives. So it makes it very easy to get software to and from the computer. It's got a little subboard that connects it up to the thumb drive, and it's got another board that powers it and has a UART to connect it up to your computer. So you just plug it into your computer, it gets power from your computer, connect up with the virtual, I think, trying to remember if it's an FTDI, but anyway, it doesn't matter. It's one of those serial to USB converters. So you can bring up TeraTerm or PuTTY or whatever, connect up to it and compute like it's the 1980s all over again with a tiny little computer. And another of the interesting things is all of the lines, like the address lines, the data lines, the status lines, are brought out. And again, I'm showing it, but mm-hmm. I'll describe it. These are 0.1 pitch plugs on the computer, which means that you can take this entire edge and plug it into a solderless breadboard and then connect up other things to it. So
cool.
It's in that way, it's expandable. Also, it's got a ZIF socket for the BIOS for the boot ROM. So at the point that you want to burn another ROM, you can just pop this one out and change it and pop it back in easily without bending the pins or messing up your system, because it's on a nice little ZIF socket there. So I like it. And they've got an interactive forum where you can ask for tech support. I did. I noticed that Control-C didn't work. I was thinking that makes it difficult to break out of some programs that expect you to use a Control-C to end them, which a few do. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, the Microsoft Macro Assembler and the Microsoft Linker. And they said, yep, you're right. That doesn't work. Should be part of the CPM call and work on patching that. And other people have been posting projects that they're working on to interface other hardware to it, like a parallel hardware. You know, simple stuff right now, like just blink an LED, but it's still fun, kind of like the old days. So anyway, having fun with that, thought that I'd share it, and we'll have a link for that in the show notes. That's the link that I put in there, Paul, that 8-bit mm-hmm. stack.
Very cool. All right, and then backing up through the alphabet to Carrington. I don't know why I didn't. I guess you hadn't put anything in there at the point. So what closing thoughts do you have?
I want to bring everyone's attention to the People's Republic of Interactive Fiction, which is the Boston local society of people into text adventures and modern things. Yeah, exactly. And so they have a monthly meeting where everyone gets together and hangs out there. And it's not a thing I can go to, partly because COVID and partly because Boston. But during this period of COVID, they've been doing their meetings online and basically anybody can join. And it's super fun. So I should have mentioned it before, but they have a monthly meeting. And if you go to pr-if.org, you can kind of learn about it and sign up to get a notice for like a week in advance of when the next meeting will be. It looks like we just did one, which was it looks like 17th of May. So it'll be roughly that same time again, middle of next month will be the June one. And it's fun. Just a bunch of people hang out. I often go now. Kay, friend of the show, Kay Savitz, we do Emo Grew together. He'll often come as well. And other people who have popped in out of the show are sometimes there. And it's just fun. People just kind of talk about like what's new. Has anybody worked on interactive fiction stuff? Have you played a recent game? Are you doing anything in it? It's just kind of like a chat hangout for an hour or so. And it's super fun. So if you're not in Boston, well, COVID is still going on. It's a thing you can participate in. Once they can have in-person meetings again, there may no longer be a virtual one. So might be a rare chance to actually enjoy the IF camaraderie while you can. So people should come hang out. It's fun.
Yeah, I did. I went to one. I'm not sure exactly why he was here, but Kay was in town. And so like I physically went to one that Kay physically was also at. Nick Monfort's office that it met in is it's really something. You know, he's got it laid out really nicely with all his, you know, old computers all around and mostly working stuff like that. So that was also fun. When I was, you know, the one I was at, you know, there was a fair amount of discussion of, you know, like it was a little bit like what we talked about, I think, last time with this Perestroika game. You know, somebody was working with I don't think it was that actual one. Maybe it was actually that actual game, but you know, sort of trying to revive an old game. It's a neat group, and I've never been back.
Yeah, and the cool thing is, it's some people super experienced, like Andrew Plotkin, kind of runs it. It seems Zarfin, you know. He's very well known in IF technology, but there's other people who just are dropping in saying, I'm interested in this. And they say, well, what does that mean? And how do you play that game? And like, so there's like super experienced people down to total IF noobs. I find it very welcoming because I kind of fall in the middle there. Yeah, I dig it. People should come hang out.
What about you, Paul?
So one thing that I forgot to mention last time, but although this has been in my notes, but I've been watching For All Mankind, which is, you know, I think that's come up before. You know, it's basically a slightly alternate reality version of the kind of space race time, Cold War time. And, you know, so little changes about like, what if you know, Russia got there first and, you know, what implications does that have and that kind of thing. In the current season, which you know, it's fairly recently released. There's a nice Apple II Plus that's featured quite a bit in it. One of the characters is like, you know, word processing on it, but it's you know, it seems pretty accurate. I don't have complaints.
Cool.
What streaming service or what network is that on?
I think it's an Apple TV one.
Oh, okay.
So
I think so too.
And let's see what else. I have a couple of my little sort of like portable type machines here. I have a SX64, a Commodore SX64, and a Trona Attaché. And I plugged them in just to see, you know, just so I could say something about it. The SX64, it does what I sort of remember it doing, which is that I turn it on, I get the nice sort of blue screen, you know, the Commodore blue screen. It has a color screen built in, which is kind of sort of unusual for things of this form factor. But the keyboard doesn't do anything. You know, so I plug in the keyboard and it doesn't actually operate. And it might be the cable. I don't know. There's kind of static on the screen too. And so I looked into this a little bit, and it does seem like there's a kind of common thing that happens with these where the just a junction between a couple of boards inside wiggles loose a little bit. So I'm going to maybe try to open it and see if I can get that working. Because I would, if I'm going to have a Commodore 64, I would like that to be it. You know, I would like that to be the one that
it's
I use.
Nice and compact.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
looks good. At, you know, like it just fits on the Starbucks table. You know? So, but anyway, so I'm pleased that it, you know, like it comes up and I can see, you know, it says Commodore Basic, and if I fiddle a little bit with the wire, then it glitches, and you know, the word Basic turns into like B, you know, like BVSIC or something like that, and I'm not quite sure what the deal is with that, but it doesn't seem healthy. anyway, I think I'm looking forward to that, and also I'm kind of liking the fact that it's a machine that you can just put away when you're not actually using it. It takes much less space than some of these other ones that are just set up. Anyway, that's what I've been doing. Not much editing recently. That's about it.
Because you pushed out all the shows.
So now it's going to seem like they're taking forever to come through. Yeah. Oh, we have...
Well, for those listening, in case you like check your feed, because some people might be used to the shows coming out with a wider gap, so you might have missed one. A lot of times people only keep the latest show or latest episode in their feed. There might be one or two
because
that are behind that you haven't heard.
For like, I don't know, a week or something, they were coming out like once every other day or something like that. But, Rob O'Hara in our chat.
Oh, hello, Rob.
Said that Stephen, I don't actually know how to pronounce this person's name, Vogt, maybe, has a new interactive fiction game out today.
News from Rob. That's exciting. I love new IF games. Oh, look at this. So it's called Hibernated One, the Director's Cut, and it's available for a whole bunch of different platforms. Commodore 64, Amstrad, Spectrum, Puddle, Amiga, Apple II, Atari ST, bunch of stuff. So this could be an example of something that maybe was made in Puny Inform, which we talked about last episode before, because you can get those running on a ton of old platforms fairly easily. So I wonder if it's using that format. That's exciting. Hooray for new IF. Nice tip, Rob.
Excellent.
And also, hello, Rob. I love your podcasts. Everyone should listen to Rob's.
Right. Definitely. Absolutely. Rob also points out that this game not only runs on the Commodore 64, but also runs on the SX64 if the keyboard works. So.
But is there a play-by-mail version, Rob?
I hope. That would be great. Like whatever, a Parsley game or whatever, but it takes 15 years to play. Actually, we did this once at Kansas Fest. I think it was a Parsley game, but it was essentially, you know, so you have many people providing commands to somebody who's acting as the interpreter, but because these people cannot agree on what they're doing, we spent like half an hour just climbing up and down a ladder.
Yep, I remember that. And you hear the groans where there's been a kind of an unmentioned consensus where everyone thinks we should go up this ladder, and then somebody's turn will come and they say go down. And Gotti's like, oh!
The days. Yes. Anyway, soon we will be able to do that again. But,
yes.
Okay.
One hopes.
Anyway, that is it for this show. You can find the notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes. That may do something. And until next time,
Retro Compute.